Blog Talk Radio. We must also realize that the problems of racial injustice and economic injustice cannot be solved without a radical redistribution of political and economic power.
But we talk about our political prison, free Larry Hoover, free Jeff Ford, and we're going to listen to Marcus Garvey tonight and his struggle, the Marcus Garvey movement, the Dr. Martin Luther King movement, also the SCLC, Southern Christian Leadership Conference. And tonight we're going to listen to the story of Marcus Garvey. A lot of people don't know about Marcus Garvey, but some of the racial things, some of the people take out of Marcus Garvey.
At the age of 34, he grew billions of followers worldwide. His controversial goal, to create an independent black nation, made him one of the most powerful people in America and one of the most hated. The federal government targeted him as a threat to national security. Rival black leaders denounced him as a lunatic and a traitor to the race. But Garvey may have been his own worst enemy.
He wasn't one to take advice from others kindly. He made his own decisions, and he would rise or fall by the decisions that he made because he was a supreme egotist.
Volatile and secretive, yet charismatic and visionary, Marcus Garvey changed forever the way black Americans looked at themselves and the world.
He started something that became bigger than Garvey himself. He, more than any other figure in the 20th century, symbolizes the turning of the perception of black people into something positive.
Garvey's father was a mason, a professional mason, and among the things that he did was to create tombs for people in the St. Anne's Bay graveyard. He took Garvey with him to the graveyard one day, and they were digging this grave, and his father had Garvey go down inside the grave, but then he pulled the ladder up and left the child in the bottom of the grave. Garvey said that he cried out and his father wouldn't let him get back up out of the grave. He wanted to teach him a lesson. Alone in the grave, young Marcus Garvey learned that he could rely on no one but himself. lesson he would carry for the rest of his life. Marcus Garvey was born in August of 1887 in St. Anne's Bay, a small town on the northern coast of Jamaica. His father, who had been born a slave, withdrew from the family for days at a time and insisted his wife and two children address him at all times as Mr. Garvey. My grandfather was a very stubborn man who had to have his way. He was quite retiring to me. The strange thing about him, he used to have his own little apartment off the main house where they lived. And he would be by himself there, reading a lot. Now, if you look at it, the thing, Marcus Garvey was like that himself too. He liked to be by himself. Marcus obviously inherited many of his characteristics. Marcus Garvey's father was repressed in many ways, a frustrated person, a person who could find no way out and seemed to have internalized much of the feeling that the world was against him. Garvey's mother raised crops and, like many women of her time, cooked for a white family to support her own. But Sarah Jane Richards wanted more for her only surviving son than a life of common labor and battlefield.
Garvey's mother had a tremendous influence upon him, and she had great hopes for him. She wanted, in fact, to call him Moses, and she thought that he was going to do a great thing. That source of love that someone, his mother in particular, loved him, helped to create that extraordinary self-confidence that Garvey had.
As a boy, Garvey imagined himself delivering speeches to adoring crowds. He spent hours reading, and even met his friend, they couldn't pick a single word from the dictionary that he didn't know.
The young Garvey had ambition. He wanted to get out of St. Anne's Bay. Later he said he dreamt of becoming the first gentleman in the world. And it seemed as if he early on developed this interest in a kind of dramatic, epic story of himself in which he would play a leading part.
But Garvey's grand ambitions were tempered by reality. As children, blacks and whites mixed easily in his community. One of his closest friends was a white named Joyce Reary. But as they became teenagers, her father put an end to the friendship.
At the age of 14, she was sent away to England and told never to speak to him because he was a nigger. And he said that's the first time that he heard and became aware of this idea of being black and what it meant. He felt shut out. He felt that he was excluded and made to feel that he was not good enough. And the rest of his life was really an attempt to prove that he was just as good as anyone else in the world.
Under the colonial education system, Garvey was forced to leave school at the age of 14. He became a printer's apprentice and quickly earned the status of master printer. In the print shop, he learned the power of controlling the written word and would soon publish his first newspaper, Garvey's Watchman.
Oh, 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 oh.
In 1910, 23-year-old Marcus Garvey set out on a journey to Central America. Supporting himself as a journalist and laborer, Garvey saw black workers harvesting plantations, loading ships, and building the Panama Canal. They were the power behind the economy, but in their isolation from each other, black people were powerless. In 1914, he came upon the book that would change his life.
Marcus Garvey's reading of Booker T. Washington's Up From Slavery was an eye-opener to him and pointed the way to his conclusion, which remained with him throughout his life, that the situation facing black people was a global one.
I was determined that the black man would not continue to be kicked about, as I had seen in Central America and as I had read of it in America. Where is the black man's government? Where is his king and his kingdom? Where is his president, his country, his men of big affairs? I could not find them. And then I declared, I will help to make them. My brain was on fire. As he sailed for home, Garvey's grand vision for himself and for the world clicked into place. He would unify black people scattered across the globe, and he would be their leader. Back in Kingston, he attended a debate and noticed an attractive 17-year-old named Amy Ashwood. When Ashwood took to the stage and delivered a powerful political speech, Garvey knew he had found a kindred spirit. He approached her later that evening as they rode home on a trolley. At last I have met the star of my destiny, Garvey exclaimed.
Her parents were very opposed to it, particularly her mother, who was trying to keep her away from Garvey because Garvey didn't seem to have a solid income or be the type of person that she wanted her daughter dating. But Garvey was a great romantic, and he announced to Ashwood that she was his Josephine.
And she says, if you are my Napoleon, and they make a pledge that they would remain together and forge what would become Universal Negro Improvement Association, and they launch it together in August of 1914. With the motto, One God, One Aim, One Destiny, the Universal Negro Improvement Association stressed race pride and sought backers for an industrial training school modeled on Booker T. Washington's Tuskegee Institute. Garvey and Ashwood attracted a small, loyal following, but there was trouble from the beginning. Garvey created enemies by attacking established leaders. He wouldn't tolerate the slightest dissent from UNIA members, and he was a disastrous money manager, using contributions to the school to pay for his own living expenses. When his few supporters clamored for an accounting, 29-year-old Garvey decided to leave town. He hired himself out on the crew of the SS Talek, and in the spring of 1916, he left Amy Ashwood behind and set sail alone for New York City. His ideas had failed in Jamaica, but they would find new life in America. When Garvey comes to the United States, Harlem is a throbbing, bubbling, exciting place. These are fantastic buildings, apartments, the street life is abundant. This is a fast-moving and a very affluent world, and it's a whole new world. Garvey quickly found lodging with the Jamaican family in Harlem and got a job as a printer.
He was not a wealthy person, far from it. living in a sort of a hall, you know, little hall bedroom, as the kind of bedroom that was very popular in Harlem in those days. So he was in pretty poor financial shape. But the idea that he had, this great desire to build a great movement, you know, sort of sustained him.
Lee Phyllis Randolph, editor of the influential Messenger magazine, heard about the young agitator from Jamaica and arranged for Garvey to deliver his first formal lecture in the United States. Garvey printed his own handbill, referring to himself as the Honorable Marcus Garvey. He painstakingly rehearsed his speech, just as he had as a boy. But when Garvey rose to address the audience, his confidence shattered. He spoke with a tremor and shook like a leaf. It seems that Garvey was anxious, he was nervous, he was heckled. He, at one point in his address, lost his balance and fell off the stage, fell into the audience. He literally fell on his face. What he had hoped would be a great sort of coming out turned into this humiliation. Crushed by the failure of his American debut, Garvey wandered into the Tabernacle Church of Reverend Billy Sunday, a white evangelist who attracted massive crowds to revival meetings. Billy Sunday was the granddaddy, the man who really created the 20th century revival figure, revivalist preacher figure in the United States. Garvey quickly takes on Billy Sunday's speaking style. Very athletic, very intense, moving a lot, and Garvey would refashion his oratory in keeping with the model of Billy Sunday. With renewed confidence in his power to move an audience, Garvey set out for a year-long tour of 38 states. His mission was still to raise money for a vocational school in Jamaica. But along the way, Garvey got a first-hand look at the contradiction of race in America. The stunning potential of the most affluent black population in the world, alongside the degradation of Jim Crow and the horrors of lynching.
Sidewalks in New Orleans at that time, but you'd walk along a plank walk. But if a white person came along, no matter who it was, a white child, a white man, a white woman, if they came along, you had to get off the plank walk and stand in the mud until they passed.
You was oppressed and depressed, disgusted that you were born in the wrong race of people because of your color. Whatever was left, that's what you got. I wonder what was left. And we were at the lowest ebb at that time. The black people were.
On July 2nd, 1917, just months after America's entry into World War I, the city of East St. Louis exploded in the worst racial rioting the country had ever seen. 39 whites and hundreds of African Americans were killed.
You have black troops going on to fight to make the world safe, democracy in April, and in July, you have black people being murdered wanted in a barbaric manner in East St. Louis, you know, children being thrown back into flaming houses, people being boarded up in their houses before they're torched. So even by American standards, East St. Louis was a horror.
Thank you.
W.E.B. Du Bois, leader of the NAACP and supporter of integration, led a silent march in response to the massacre. But to Garvey, this was no time for silence. It was time for black people to get together and fight back. He spoke out at an emergency meeting in Harlem.
The whole thing, my friends, is a bloody farce. That the police and soldiers did nothing to stem the murder thirst of the mob is conclusive proof of conspiracy on the part of the civil authorities to condone the acts of the white mob against Negroes. White people are taking advantage of black men today because black men all over the world are disunited.
It is that speech that marks the turning point of Garvey away from Jamaica, away from a preoccupation with matters related to the West Indies. And now he's not looking for support for what he's hoping to accomplish in the West Indies, but rather he's now sucked into the vortex of American race relations.
Garvey is deeply suspicious of the efforts of white liberals and of their black peers to bring about the integration of blacks in the United States. He, as a matter of fact, doesn't believe that it's possible. He does not believe that white people can represent the best interests of black people.
Garvey opened the first American division of the UNIA in September of 1917, just as he had in Jamaica. Garvey distinguished himself by calling established black leaders weak and self-serving.
Even though I had a great deal of admiration for W.E.B. Du Bois and A. Philip Randolph and other black leaders of the time, their approach to our problems was too doggone tame, and that we needed to have that attitude of Marcus Garvey, that stand up on your feet and be ready to defend your manhood at all times.
And all of a sudden, this golden voice from the Caribbean came and stood on the corners in Harlem and began to talk about self-esteem, holding up your backbone, you know, no wishbones. And Mr. Garvey gave them hope that there was a dream for black people.
Garvey told black Americans that their history did not begin with slavery. Africa's glorious past was also theirs to claim, he said, and people who had once done great things could do them again. Garvey's message was revolutionary because at that time it told black people that they had to unite together as one and believe in their roots, that they came from something greater than they were told. To begin with, Africa was called the Dark Continent. And the pictures that we got of Africa in those days were cannibals running around in the jungle, putting people in pots. Garvey changed all of that.
I am the equal of any white man. I want you to feel the same way. We have come now to the turning point of the Negro, where we have changed from the old cringing weakling and transformed into full-grown men demanding our portion as men.
Pressure that the only way there could be a difference in the way black people of African descent could be treated would be for them to have a powerful nation of their own.
Garvey toured the country again, this time initiating UNIA branches in big cities and small towns. Sunday meetings of the UNIA soon attracted thousands. A Garvey meeting was a day-long family affair, half political rally and current half-religious revival.
The first time I went to a garlic meeting was a Sunday afternoon in November of 1919. It was the first time I had heard the message of the UNIA.
The day I met Marcus Garvey was one of the most exciting days of my life. It was filled with anticipation from the earliest part of the day because I knew that I was going with my father to meet Marcus Garvey.
And when Garvey came in the door, everybody stood up in one accord and said, "Speak, Garvey, speak." And it was just like a hush on the room.
He said that the pen is mightier than the sword, but the tongue is mightier than them both put together.
Before addressing the crowd, Garvey would inhale through a perfumed handkerchief to focus his concentration. The man who once shook like a leaf on stage could now hold an audience spellbound.
When he spoke, it was as if you were speaking yourself. It was not like somebody speaking to you, but like he was you, or you was he. And it just was a connecting link, and it was something like fire, like lightning, like something that went through everybody at the same time.
Be as proud of your race today as our fathers were in the days of yore. We have a beautiful history, and we shall create another in the future that will astonish the world. I can advise no better step toward racial salvation than organization among us. We have been harassed, trampled upon, and made little of because of our unfortunate condition, disorganization. Our racial program of today is a united, emancipated, and improved people.
Garvey took black folk who were assaulted by a variety of very unfortunate and negative images of themselves and made them believe in themselves, made them see physical beauty in themselves, made them see the need to interpret and write their own history. In that sense, Garvey sold the Negro to himself.
With 35 cents, a photograph, and a pledge to support Garvey's nation-building program, any person of African descent could join the Universal Negro Improvement Association.
I saw the light. I saw the light. I saw the light. I saw the light.
Garvey's genius was to transform cooks, maids, and workmen with the pride that comes with a title and a uniform. Always think yourself a perfect being, he wrote, and be satisfied with yourself. You would almost see them let off into something else. You would see it. They'd suddenly get very tall. Because the smallest man in the uniform still looked like a giant. I can tell you that from experience. They were gorgeous. The black men were gorgeous. Jacob Samuel Mills, a master carpenter from St. Kitts, had come to Harlem in 1910. But barred from the all-white carpenters union, he could only find work as a janitor.
My father joined the Garvey movement because he thought it was something for the advancement of life. And every Sunday afternoon when he was doing his work, he put his uniform on. He felt very proud when he wore the uniform. He wore it on the trolley car and let everybody look at him and talk if they wanted to talk. But that was the effect of the uniform on everyone who saw it was electrified, but especially on white people. I heard white people say today, well, we have a big parade going down the valley. They were the ones who
car.
You and I have something for everyone. For men, that was the African vision. For young people, juvenile vision. And in the Black Cross Nursing, Universal Morning Glory, and Garvey movement offered Black women a place of their own.
It wasn't uniform everywhere. That was a difficult statement that these uniforms and women made to the rest of the world that we are copying and proud of it.
My father had once said that the occupation would have been able to develop part of the classroom. He had more women in the organization in comparison to some other men. With its elaborate rituals and official song, Garvey UNIA was a separate world. Members pledged allegiance to the red, black, and green flag, which Garvey himself designed as a symbol of a black nation.
Show me the race or the nation without a flag, and I will show you a race of people without any flag. But that was said of us 4 years ago. They can't say it now.
You go to the number of arms, the land with God's own feet, the storm clouds suddenly gather, all armies come rushing to me, and then the chorus went up there, advance to meet the movement of recovery. Women would sing that in bedroom, right? Advance, everybody, with the might of the red, the black, and the green. Advance, with the might of the red, the black, and the green.
In the summer of 1918, Garvey set out to bring in the separate out of black homes. First, just a half-finished church building when I had moved at Christmas Liberty Hall. Relying on the critics' guilt he learned in the mornings, Garvey started the Negro World newspaper, a cover price of 5 cents. The paper carried essays, poetry, and articles on Black and Secret World then. On the front page of every issue was a long editorial penned by Garvey. Would make her way to the vote in Europe. Then, to attract the dollars that flowed through black hands, Garvey created his first immense investment fund.
Garvey was aware that blacks had contributed to the war effort by purchasing over 220 million of some wealth within the black community in the United States. And his idea was that this black wealth should be converted into businesses that would benefit black and projects that would benefit black.
Garvey's idea of what I was that it would teach certain things. It was going to be a vehicle to communicate and demonstrate that black people could be successful. This idea of success is now translated into a series of commercial ventures. Laundries, restaurants, newspapers. Garvey financed UNIA and Bradford's Negro Factories Corporation, which was capitalized with small contributions from the following. At their peak, UNIA businesses employed as many as 1,000 people in time. Garvey hired managers with little or no experience. He shipped funds from one company to cover mounting losses in another. And he insisted that his followers play by his rules. When an early member of the Harlem Brass challenged his position, Garvey took me as well.
Garvey
very authoritarian and very anti-democratic in the way he ran the organization. His primary concern was in loyalty, not in competence, because he does not attract around him people who are particularly competent, and they therefore would not tell him or try to stop him from using those monies to finance other endeavors in the UNIA.
In October 1919, resentment against Darby boiled over. A disgruntled investor named George Tyler pushed his way to the UNIA network, where he naturally was not working.
Amy Ashwood didn't really want to let him in. Being disturbed, Garvey came forward and said, "What do you want?" Whereupon George Tyler pulled out a gun and began shooting. Amy Ashwood threw her body between the shooter and Garvey to protect her lover. George Tyler said, "I don't want to shoot you," trying to aim around her. She tackled Tyler and they tumbled down the stairs to the first floor. Shots were fired at him on the first floor and called the police. Came, they apprehended Tyler and took him to jail. And the news reports were that Garvey had been shot in the head, and it made a huge news flash.
And that moment becomes a turning point, because Garvey survived 3 shots. Next day, he had a big speaking engagement in Philadelphia. He goes to Philadelphia, despite the fact that he's been shot. Goes and makes it to be, and he now has this extraordinary sort of quasi-religious significant survival principle.
By the end of 1919, Garvey claimed over 3/4 million followers, and the Negro World was the most popular black newspaper in the United States. But his rise in the news would soon make him a target of the federal government and a growing number of black prisoners who called the UNIA the House of Congress. At the end of World War I, the four powers set up their side to compete in 5 colonial territories. From the seat of the self-styled empire in Harlem, Marcus Garvey argued that it was time to give Africa back money. Some said it would bring him back. But Garvey's slogan, "Africa for the African," reverberated around the world and spread through the colonies. In Europe, Garvey began to be seen as a threat. The United States worked with the British government during World War I. They continued that effort with the focus on Garvey, because the British government was definitely Garvey was going to spread revolution. They feared the hundreds of thousands of amassed blacks under his influence. Undoubtedly, Garvey did stir up nationalism.
I say this plainly and for everybody to hear. We are organizing to drive every pale face out of Africa. Do you know why? Because Africa is mine. Africa is the land of my fathers. We who make up this organization know no turning back. We have pledged ourselves, even unto the last drop of our sacred blood, that Africa must be free.
Garvey's Negro World, now published in Spanish, French, and English, carried news of rebellion around the world. In Africa and the Caribbean, colonial authorities banned the newspaper. But with over 500 divisions of UNIA in 22 countries, Garvey's message could not be stopped. The Negro World was being smuggled into Kenya by seamen, black seamen, and then it would be read aloud to groups of people around this reader, plus young children, young boys in particular, who were charged with memorizing Garvey's editorial
going to say, would read out, and then these young boys would run off, having memorized it, run off to the villages and spread Garvey's word in that way. In the United States, black troops returned from World War I with high expectations of change. But they returned to a country that was not ready for equality, a country increasingly suspicious of radical political movements. In this unsettled climate, Garvey's appeal to disgruntled African Americans with military training sounded an alarm. Attorney General Palmer decided that there needed to be a special division of the Justice Department, called it the General Intelligence Division. And he picked a young Justice Department attorney. He was really unknown at that time, but must have been known enough for his diligence, and his name was J. Edgar Hoover. Garvey really gets pinpointed. Hoover, the Justice Department, were clearly hooked on a fixation on Garvey, which would before long become a vendetta. J. Edgar Hoover wrote to a colleague, Garvey is a notorious Negro agitator, affectionately referred to by his own race as the Negro Moses. Hoover's agents were in the audience at Carnegie Hall when Garvey bragged that the UNIA would soon be strong enough to exact its own form of justice.
When those crackers lynch a Negro below the Mason-Dixon line, since it is not safe to lynch a white man in any part of America, we shall press the button and lynch him in Africa.
The agent reported that Garvey's address was met with great applause and much excitement. J. Edgar Hoover had long relied on casual informants, but now, in his determination to go after Garvey, Hoover hired the first full-time black agent in the Bureau's history. He was known by a code number. All his reports were signed 800. That was his code. And his job was to go into Harlem and to infiltrate the Garvey movement to try and find evidence that could be used to build the legal case for ultimately getting rid of Garvey. Garvey rejected America. They could no more agree to and accept a militant rejection of America by blacks than they could accept a militant demand for full inclusion by blacks. Just as the government campaign against him escalated, Marcus Garvey unveiled a new business enterprise. It was his most ambitious venture, but would prove to be the most fateful.
Get on board, everyone. Get on board, stay the sun. Get on board, countryman. Wine home on the top of the line. Wine home on the top of the line.
The idea comes to them that black people need a shipping line. And he bases his idea on the fact that the Cunard family has the White Star Line, and the Irish have the Green Star Line. And he says, why shouldn't blacks have the Black Star Line? So it is a vision of grandeur.
Black people would routinely Jim Crow on ocean-going liners. Black folk paying, say, for first-class accommodation often had to travel in third-class accommodation. Black people on ships had to eat after the white people had finished eating. So all of these problems Garvey was trying to address through a shipping corporation.
His ships would carry more than passengers. Garvey envisioned commercial trade among black communities around the world, with produce, raw materials, and manufactured goods transported on UNIA vessels.
The Black Star Line was in some ways Garvey's Empire State Building. It was this monument to black commerce, in the same way that the Empire State Building was this citadel of white capitalism. And it represented the ability of black people to seize the day and to have their own economy.
Garvey
Garvey offered Black Star Line stock for sale in 1919, promising his investors liberation and large profits as they slept.
My parents spent a small fortune in Garvey shares. They were $5 a piece in those days, which is a lot of money. And my mother had to remind my father that there was food and things to be bought because he was buying shares. And Daddy had those on his dresser. And I remember reaching out and touching them. And Daddy said, touch them and feel the power that the black man will someday know.
Get on board, countryman. Get on board, please.
Just months after his first stock offering, Garvey stunned the world with the purchase of the Black Star Line's first ship.
Let our steamship sail the high seas. Not one, not two, but hundreds of them. The stronger we become upon land and sea, the more will be the respect shown to us, and the greater will be the glory.
The SS Yarmouth, a 33-year-old wartime coal boat that Garvey planned to rename the Frederick Douglass, would set sail with an all-black crew under the command of Joshua Coburn, a black captain. One bright November morning in 1919, Garveyites assembled on the pier at 135th Street in Harlem to witness the launching of the Ark. A spectator said, "We watched people jump up and down, throw up their hats and handkerchiefs, and cheer while the Yarmouth backed from the wharf and slowly glided down the North River. The ship appeared to embark on a spectacular ocean voyage, but because Garvey had not finished paying for it, the Yarmouth went only as far as the 23rd Street Pier. But when the Yarmouth finally made its maiden voyage, it was cause for an international celebration. The president of Cuba threw a banquet in honor of the crew, and members of his cabinet purchased shares in the Black Star Line. In Costa Rica, workers descended on the dock to shower the Yarmouth with fruits and flowers.
It was announced that one of the ships of the Black Star Line would be coming to Panama and going through the canal. I was a very small boy at the time, and my brother and I were given packed lunches, sandwiches, drinks, and were packed off to a place called Christchurch by the Sea, waiting to see this garbage ship arrive. We got there at about 9:10 in the morning, midday, no ship, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, no ship, but we were still there waiting. 9 o'clock, no ship. At about 9:30, 10, my brother put me on his back and we were on the way home. But the ship never actually came.
There's no denying the fact that Garvey's Black Star steamship line was a wonderful symbol, was a powerful symbol. But it was nothing more than that, I think, a symbol. The fact that people would come down to the dock waiting for these ships, in some ways is metaphoric for the wishful thinking that was largely at the heart of the Garvey movement.
Garvey was betrayed by the few people he trusted to get the Black Star Line afloat. The man he asked to inspect the Yarmouth turned out to be an informant for J. Edgar Hoover. And his hand-picked captain, Joshua Coburn, convinced Garvey to pay 6 times what the ship was worth, and then took a kickback from the purchase price. Yet Garvey quickly raised and spent $200,000 on 2 more ships.
And making the purchase of those items without being led by experts, he was deceived. And overpaid for their own, what their value should have been. It was a disaster for the movement. that turned out to be a disaster for Mr. Garvey.
At the end of 1919, Marcus Garvey married Amy Ashwood, the woman who just months earlier had thrown herself in the line of fire to save his life.
They had a very rocky relationship, a lot of off again, on again, a lot of quarreling, and finally they married in a spectacular Liberty Hall marriage on Christmas Day.
Their extravagant wedding was the talk of Harlem. Five different ministers performed the ceremony before 3,000 guests. Just 4 months later, the couple separated. Having a wife was an impediment to my work and peace of mind, Garvey would later say. I can't pay her personal attention, the average husband. In fact, I have no time to look after myself.
My father was committed totally to the struggle, and that's why he never seemed to relax. He never seemed to take a day off. He was always committed to the struggle. He was always appeared to be dressed, ready to work. And he's working at home. He was working at the office. He kept tremendous hours. So it was a total commitment to the struggle and the cause.
The UNIA was taking in thousands of dollars a day, but Garvey lived modestly on the sixth floor of a Harlem apartment building. He didn't drink or smoke, and preferred to eat the same food night after night. Garvey spent his few idle hours arranging and rearranging a collection of Egyptian vases and African ornaments under the private world. Unless it was about UNIA business, Garvey rarely spoke to even his closest associates.
We must also realize that the problems of racial injustice and economic injustice cannot be solved without a radical redistribution of political and economic power.
We read one day, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But if a man doesn't have a job or an income, he has neither life nor liberty and the possibility for the pursuit of happiness. He merely exists. Estimated that we spend $322,000 for each enemy we kill in Vietnam, while we spend in the so-called war on poverty in America only about $53 for each person classified as poor. The promises of the Great Society have been shut down on the battlefield of Vietnam, making the poor, white and Negro, bear the heaviest burden both at the front and at home.
The other thing I want you to understand is this, that it didn't cost the nation one penny to integrate lunch counters.
Well,
it didn't cost the nation one penny to guarantee the right to vote. But now we are dealing with issues that cannot be solved without the nation spending billions of dollars and undergoing a radical redistribution of economic power.
Yes, yes.
All labor has dignity.
Yes.
But you are doing another thing. You are reminding not only Memphis, but you are reminding the nation that it is a crime for people to live in this rich nation and receive starvation wages.
America's opportunity
help bridge the gulf between the haves and the have-nots.